This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Open for business on BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, good morning and welcome to Open for Business, the show that dives into the journeys and ventures of entrepreneurs and business leaders. This morning on the show, Michele Ferrario, co-founder and CEO of digital wealth platform Stashaway, commonly known as robo-advisors, digital wealth managers, were an exciting development in the financial industry with OG players such as Wealthfront and Betterment coming to life post-2008 global financial crisis. The ultimate idea here is making investing cheaper, easier, and more accessible. Some players have struggled to find a strong, profitable footing, with some players in the US having to adjust or pivot their models in order to work, or ultimately getting acquired. Today, we'll dive into how Stashaway is navigating this challenge and how they're trying to make this business model work, but also, more importantly, look back to 2016 and find out why the now former CEO of Zalora switched industries and jumped into wealth management. Michele, welcome to the studio, and it's a pleasure to actually finally meet you in person and have this conversation not over Zoom.
Thank you for having me, and likewise, absolutely a pleasure to finally meet you.
You know, Michele, I look at your story here, and you know, you were the then CEO of Zalora. When you started this, Betterment and Wealthfront were around 8 years old, more or less, still struggling to break even that time, let alone turn a profit. So the question that always comes back to me is, what gave you the conviction and the confidence to possibly sink the next decade of your life? Now we're 8 years in already, right?
Yes.
Into this venture. What was it?
Look, the idea and the conviction came from my personal experience, meaning that in 2016, I had been in Singapore for 4 years. I was the CEO of Zalora, as you mentioned. I was in my mid-30s back then. I had two kids back then. Now I have 3 plus 1 coming. I was working very hard. I was starting to accumulate savings. I have a background in finance, and so I knew what I wanted to do with it. And I realized that the banks made it impossible to do something that I thought made some sort of sense. And so I started looking for alternatives. I find out about Betterment and Wealthfront in the US. I looked for a Singapore-based similar player with the idea of investing my money there, and I couldn't find any. And that's how the idea came about. So this was kind of the first piece of it. The second piece of it is, once I thought that was a big problem, because I know it was my problem. I've spoken to a bunch of people asking, you know, how do you solve this? And a lot of people told me, you don't. and there's no sort of real solution. So after I kind of convinced that it was a big problem, looking at the solution in the US, I thought as a client myself that those were solutions that I would have liked. Then the second step has been meeting my co-founders. And when I, we can go deeper into this, but when I met them, I realized that together we had what I thought was the right level of skills required to build something like this. So that gave me the conviction of, okay, not only there is a problem, I think that I know what a solution could look like, but I actually also have the confidence that together with these two guys, we can actually build it.
So this was a problem, your own itch to scratch, and not necessarily ready for that business venture just yet until you met your other two co-founders, that the equation started to come together. How did you meet Freddie and Nino?
Yeah, so this was, I guess, the one part that would be very difficult to replicate. If you told me that you started all over again, I would say, look, I probably could do everything better, except meeting Nino and Freddie. There's a stroke of luck. Look, Nino was introduced to me a year before. I had never met him. We had a call when he moved to Singapore. I told him, hey, you could be the CTO of Zalora, but I have one. Not looking for one. Sorry, cannot help you. That was kind of the call we had a year earlier. and so when I kind of started thinking about what then became Stashaway, I reached out and said, hey, are you still around? What are you doing? Let's meet for coffee. So we met for coffee one day. I told him what I kind of had in mind. He was, was doing something, was not very happy with it. and Nino has built several companies before as a kind of a tech co-founder. You know, he's a computer scientist, 20 years building companies. So when I told him about what I had in mind, he was surprised there was nobody else in Southeast Asia doing it. He thought it made a lot of sense. He was familiar with the business model. He's originally from Germany, and he's seen similar players kind of popping up in Europe as well. And so after coffee, after coffee, after coffee, you know, around a week after, I kind of, you know, I convinced him that this was a good idea. I really enjoyed the conversation with him. And so that's how I met him.
The most important question then, Michele, is how many coffees did it take to convince Nino to come and join?
It was around five coffees, I think, five days in a row, like 1 week in a row. I think, honestly, it was very quick, on both sides. Like, you know, on one side, I convinced him that this was a good idea. And also, I guess he also got convinced that I was a good person to work with. And on my side, similarly, I kind of got very much convinced that he had everything it would take to just build a tech platform. He had done it before, extremely successfully. He built a company called Personio that was recently valued at like $7 billion. So, you know, he has done this before.
He's a builder.
He's done it before. He's an amazing guy. So that was Nino. And then together we said, okay, let's do this. This was, so I met Nino on the 16th of July, 2016. And then we said, okay, let's do this. Let's find an investment co-founder. And so I reached out to a number of people on LinkedIn. I was looking for somebody that had went through the global financial crisis, so at least 10 years of experience back then in 2016. Met with a few people. You know, people kind of responded to me because of a little bit of my profile, I guess. People were curious about what does this guy want from me. And so I had these coffee chats, and I was a bit underwhelmed by the fact that, you know, I thought it was going to be very difficult to convince somebody to come out of their corner office in a bank with, you know, assistants working for them, you know, very, very large salaries, mm-hmm. and kind of move into a scrappy office with low salary and high risk and no assistants. And until Nino was interviewing a UX designer, and this UX designer told Nino, hey, you should meet with this guy named Freddie. So I met Freddie for coffee. And this was on the 3rd of August, so a couple of weeks later. Freddie had left Nomura already, where he was a managing director. He wanted to do something entrepreneurial. He had been asking this UX designer to design some stuff, but he had never built a company before.
Huh.
While on our side, Nino and I had built companies before, but obviously didn't have the investment experience that Freddie brought to the table. And so, you know, my 1 hour coffee with Freddie became a 3.5 hours brainstorming session on how you actually build the investment logic behind something like, you know, what then became Stash Away. And so, yeah, and so we were off to a start. And this was, again, 3rd of August. And then on the 9th of September, so a month later, we incorporated the company. We didn't have a brand name yet. In fact, the company is not called Stash Away. It's called Asia Well Platform. and then from there, we started.
And so Nino bringing that tech background, he's a CTO, naturally. Yes. Freddie bringing that financial acumen and intelligence that you need, and that experience, right, to go through a GFC. You had your experience managing Zalora. You were the CEO there. What did you bring to the table in this equation?
It's a good question. I'm not sure. I think you should ask Nino and Freddie. But anyway, no, jokes aside, I think what I brought to the table is a bit of the, I was the generalist, right? So Nino took care of tech and product. Freddie took care of the investment side of things, and I took care of everything else. And everything else is, at the beginning, was a lot of regulatory topics, you know, filing for the license. It was fundraising. It was building a team together with Nino mostly, because we're mostly kind of on the engineering side, especially at the beginning. And then it also, when we launched, it became also marketing, right? Acquiring clients. And so, you know, the combination of that was my initial role. And then obviously over time, as we hired more people, some of these roles have been taken on by people that can do this much better than I can. You know, that's how we grew the company.
Now, given your past experience, before you committed yourself to this idea of what would eventually become Stashaway, did you look at other industries?
No, my story is not that I wanted to be an entrepreneur and I looked for an idea. I was leaving Zalora for a number of reasons, and I was thinking about what to do next. I had this big issue myself of managing my savings, and I just thought it was a big opportunity. And then things kind of happened. I mean, Nino, then I met Freddie, and kind of, you know, 1 + 1 = 2. And, you know, 2 months later, we were actually doing this.
Michele, we got to go into a few messages. When we come back, we'll talk more about the journey over the last 8 years. And also, what dictates the product evolution that's taken place over at Stashaway? Folks, I've been speaking with Michele Ferraro. He's the co-founder and CEO of digital wealth platform Stashaway. I'm Roshan Gunnison. You're listening to Open for Business. We'll be back in just a bit. So keep it here to BFM 89.9, the business station.
Buggy free minimum. BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to Open for Business. I'm Roshan Kunnison, and this morning I'm speaking with Michele Ferrario, co-founder and CEO of digital wealth platform Stashaway. Michele, earlier we got a sense for the journey, the early days of how this idea came together. You had a problem that you wanted to fix for yourself, and you happened to meet Nino, one of the co-founders who became the CTO, and then you went and searched for a financial investment co-founder, which was Freddie, and how that all that came together in building Stashaway. Now, it's been an 8-year journey-ish, more or less, and you've gone through the highs of 2021, the not-so-great time of 2022, and the AUM drawdowns that came with that. And now things, I think, are a lot better in terms of the markets, at least for now. What have been key lessons that you've personally learned in this journey of yours over the last 8 years, building and running Stashaway?
As you mentioned, it's been a great journey so far. It's been 8 years, and I was joking earlier that this Stashaway has now been the longest employer in my career, and I'm very happy. And I can see it lasting for a bit longer for sure. As you mentioned, there has been, as in every entrepreneurial story, I think there are very few exceptions. There has been ups and downs. We've been lucky that there have been way more ups than downs. I'm very happy where we are today. But as an investment platform, as a digital wealth management platform, we are in a way linked to what happens in the markets. And so you mentioned 2020, 2021, after the COVID crash, markets recovered very quickly. And people got very much interested in investing. There was great times for kind of a lot of tailwind for us that helped us. And then you rightly mentioned that 2022 was from a macro perspective a terrible year. In fact, given that our core value proposition is build diversified portfolios across asset classes, when you actually look at 2022 was the worst year since 1935, if I remember correctly, so close to 100 years for the combination of equities and bonds when you put them together.
Everything went down.
So, exactly. So 2022 was tough from that perspective. To be fair, we actually did okay in 2022. We didn't grow as fast as 2021, but we kept growing, which I think it was quite an achievement. And it looks like a lot of our clients have listened to our main message of don't look at the market, keep investing through the ups and downs. Not everyone, but a lot of our clients keep doing that, which is great. And not just for the business, but I think it's great for them because now they look back and the investment they made in 2022 are some of the best investment they made, right?
Yeah, I'm sure.
Because when you invest on the market is down and you look back when the markets are up again, you say, oh, that was a good idea. So anyway, learnings. I think the core learnings, especially talking to maybe other entrepreneurs that might be listening right now, the core learnings are actually confirmation of learnings I had in the past. So the first core thing is it's all about people. And I know this has been said and discussed multiple times. I know I'm maybe boring on this topic, but but the reality is that it's so important that it needs to be flagged so many times. I was joking earlier that the one thing that would be very difficult to replicate was meeting Nino and Freddie. And I mean it, meaning that, obviously, I believe people are the core of everything we do. And whether, the only way to make a company successful is making sure you have all the right people in the right places with the right set of motivations and the right set of tools. And it all starts from the top. And so in my case, it started from the co-founders. And so without Nino and Freddie, it would have not been possible. And then, now we are 150 people. So now there is another 147 people that I need to give credit for. And over the years, obviously many more than that. And so that remains the core, making sure you get the right people on the bus, you give them the right tools, you show them the way, you lead by example, and then you let them do it. Like you get out of their way. I mean, this remains the core learning. Second piece is you need to think long term. We always tell clients, think long term for your investments. I think it's important as an entrepreneur to do the same and not be distracted by what happens this week, this month, or what maybe an investor mentions this month, but rather continue to have a vision, try to walk toward that vision, and trying to make sure that everything you do personally and as an organization pushes you in directionally where you want to go, and have the patience to see the results. Not everything takes one day, So Rome wasn't built in a day, right? That's, given I'm Italian, I guess I can use the quote.
Yes.
And I think that's an important piece that you need to remember. You need to have sense of urgency as an entrepreneur, but at the same time, the right patience to actually see things kind of coming up and working.
And that's an interesting dichotomy, right? Or at least to reconcile those two things. On one part, that startup urgency, building the business, growing the business. But on the other part, you're dealing with investing and also this long-term compounding nature of it. So you have to tell the clients, like, even to build a business, right, to build your AUM, it's a patience, long-term compounding business. So I guess that's an interesting thing, and we might dive into that a little further earlier. But I want to touch on that belief component, because you mentioned earlier in our conversation outside, when I asked you earlier on, it was a lot of family offices that came in terms of the funding, and that the VCs didn't necessarily believe in the business model back then. How did you tap into these family offices? Because not the easiest network to get into as well. So how was the early days of fundraising like for you?
Yeah, so the most difficult fundraise that we have done was what we call the pre-Series A. It was really a seed round, actually. This was pre-launch in early 2017. Mm. So at that point, we had a team of 10, 12 people. We had a clear idea. We had a prototype that we were building. We were working with MAS to get a license in Singapore. At a certain point, we got an in-principle approval, and we needed capital to make that in-principle approval a full license and to get working capital to start the company. So we're trying to raise a bit more than $2 million. That was the idea. And I spoke to 125 investors, and 124 said, no, thank you. Which, you're speaking to smart people, and you're telling them, hey, I'm investing all of my life and energy into this, and they tell you it's not going to work, and you hear that 124 times in a row, that's actually quite a tough...
Yeah, that's going
to
be tough.
...couple of months to go through, or 2-3 months to go through. And in practice, the logic there was that everybody was looking at the U.S., and in the U.S., the Betterment Welfare Fund at the time, they were not considered success stories for investors. Mm-hmm. Now, this might change, but at the time, that was the situation. And so everybody was saying, hey, if it doesn't work in the U.S., it will not work here. Failing to, I think, understand the differences. And, the situation in the U.S. was very different. It's not like in Southeast Asia where your best bet was, your best alternative to what we were doing is going to the bank and being sold the unit trust with 2.5% entry fees and 1.8% annual management fee. So the alternative in the U.S. were much better. So the Betterment and Wealthfront value proposition was not as distinctive as I think Stashaway's value proposition is in Southeast Asia, which is why I had conviction. So as you mentioned, the problem was, okay, we still believe very much in what we're doing, even if a lot of VCs told me you should do B2B. And we're like, no, we're doing this B2C because we don't want to dilute the value proposition. So we still believe in that. How do we found, family office? And this was like talking to a number of people, and everybody told us, oh, you have a great team. We like what you're doing, but not for us. Why don't you talk to this other guy? And so it was kind of a network that was built by getting rejection. So every rejection usually came with at least one recommendation to talk to somebody else. And at a certain point, we found this family that actually believed in what we were doing, and they backed us. And thanks to them, we're in business.
Well, was there what was the point that got this particular family to invest?
So I think what they told me is that, because I actually had a conversation with them before getting in principle approval from MAS, and they were a bit skeptical on what we were doing. And then after I got in principle approval, and in the meantime, I got a number of other no thank yous, I went back to them and said, hey, what are you not convinced about? By the way, we have the license. And I think they were surprised that we got the license. Huh. And so I think that there was, in practice, a moment of realization that, hey, maybe these three guys can actually get stuff done. And I think that's where the conviction came. And they come from a financial services background, so they understood in depth what we were trying to do. And, Francis Rosario, who's kind of the father, let's say, figure in the family, has been the CEO of Citibank in a number of countries. So he knew exactly what we were trying to do, and I think the final conviction was, okay, they got the license. This is actually a difficult piece. Maybe it's worth a shot.
Now, Since Stashway started, you know, the product has evolved along the way, right? So Stashway started with portfolios backed and curated and created by the in-house Era framework. Since then, you've got Stashway Simple has come in. You've got the thematic portfolios, flexible portfolios. I'm sure I'm missing a few other products that have come along the way on the spot here. But in markets like Singapore, you've also gone higher up the value chain with Stashway Reserve and other more inaccessible products, usually in the PE world, in PE space, if I understand correctly, which caters more to high net worth individuals and accredited investors. Michele, talk to us about, you know, what drives or dictates product development over at Stashway.
Look, we try to always start from the client and what problems clients have and how we can best solve them. And then we go back to our core mission, which is empowering people to build and protect their wealth for the long term, and our core value proposition. So internally, the way I would describe it is that we want to make it simple and cost-effective to invest intelligently. So simplicity, cost-effectiveness, intelligence of the investment framework. And so the combination of client needs or client problems and our beliefs on simplicity, costs, intelligence, or what then drive what we decide to do or not to do on the product development side. And remember that as you develop a product and you launch new features, new kind of new options, there is a risk that you make the product more complex. So the first pillar of simplicity is very important to make sure that you actually maintain this focus on, you know, this takes away complexity from people's life. It doesn't take away sophistication. So the solution needs to be sophisticated. That's the intelligence part. But it shouldn't make it hard to make choices. It shouldn't be hard to you know, to use and to go through this. And so those are the core pillars. And this led us to you know, build things like Stashway Simple, for instance. You know, core issue is people in Southeast Asia have way too much cash. They should be, we be way more invested. In particular, that cash, now it's slightly better, but it used to yield 0.05% on a bank account. Now maybe it's 1%. And so you have a lot of money that is doing nothing for you. That's the client problem. How do we make it simple and cost-effective and intelligent? And so we came out with a solution, Stashway Simple, that in practice is, you know, make it very easy to invest, to get access to money market funds at incredibly low fees, giving back all the rebates to the clients in a couple of clicks. And so now you have, instead of making, you know, 1% or 0.5%, you actually make 3.5%, 4%, depending on, you know, the time. And it's very simple. So that's, you know, one example of how you bring this, the need on one side and the beliefs on the other, to actually build the product. And we call this Stashway Simple as a kind of a, to differentiate it versus the banks, where the banks tell you, look, I'll give you 0.05%, but if you have a mortgage with me, I'll give you 0.5%. And if you have between 25 and 50,000 ringgit, I'll give you 1%. And between 50 and 75, I'll give you that. And if you have a credit card, I'll give you a bit more. And if you're blonde, I'll give you a bit more. And that's complexity that we wanted to take out of the system, hence the Stashway Simple brand.
Folks, I've been speaking with Michele Ferrario. He is the co-founder and CEO of digital wealth platform Stashway. I'm Roshan Gunderson. You're listening to Open for Business. We'll be back right after the news, so keep it here at BFM 89.9, the business station.
Beautiful festive moments. BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to Open for Business. I'm Roshan Gunderson, and this morning I'm speaking with Michele Ferrario, co-founder and CEO of digital wealth platform Stashway. Michele, during the first half an hour of this conversation, we've gotten a sense for how this started, why you wanted to do this. I mean, you're the ex-CEO of Zalora. You could have easily gone into another e-commerce business and built that, but digital wealth was something that spoke to you, was an itch you wanted to scratch. Now, given the climate that we're in, but also given the age that Stashway is now at, profitability is a key theme for you also to focus on. But from the outside in, and in someone who is a big supporter of robo-advisors, right? Yeah. I think I want to be clear up front, it's always about that concern about whether the model works with the thin margins that you operate. It all comes down to scale. And getting to a certain AUM. I think you hit $1 billion in 2021. I think that was the last number that we got publicly. Is the success of this business model going to come down to how capital efficient you are versus and the ability to scale the AUM?
Look, the success of the business model is, as every company, kind of finding the right chemistry between all the elements. In reality, this is actually a very high variable margin model. So variable margins are extremely high on an absolute level. Of course, when you look at it client by client, because we are so cost effective, the margins per client tend to be small. And that's why you require scale. But the P&L profile, the kind of profit and loss account of a company like ours actually looks extremely good, which is why over time then we actually did get the VCs to invest, because once the numbers were clear, people really liked the unit economics of the business model. And so it's just it's a question of scale. Like, we're not far away. So the business model actually works quite well. In fact, I read recently the Wealthfront in the US, obviously is a different scale than ours, actually are they announced a 40% EBITDA margin. So so they are a different scale. We are not there yet, but we're actually not too far away from following their footsteps.
So the variable margin there is quite interesting. That's because also you've got different tiers of products as well, right, that cater to that. Not everyone is using a Stashaway product at 0.8% per annum in terms of the costing. How does Stashaway Reserve and the products there factor into your ability to possibly expand margins?
Look, Reserve is for us an important segment. So Reserve is our proposition for high net worth individuals. As of now, it's only live in Singapore and Hong Kong. Over time, we'll probably bring to all of our markets, you know, Malaysia, Thailand, and Dubai as well.
I know people who are waiting.
Yes. And Reserve is a segment for us. It's a high net worth individuals. And actually around 25% of our assets come from this segment. Now, this segment obviously invest the majority of their assets in our core portfolios, because everyone should have 60, 70, 80% of their money in diversified portfolios across asset classes. That's our core, what we call the managed portfolio or general investing. And then they have access to additional products, private equity, private credit, which we just launched, angel investing, and crypto, that can complement their portfolios and add further diversification and potentially extra returns over time. So these extra products are a good way to differentiate further the product and attract high net worth clients, but the core of the offering, even for high net worth clients, remains better cash management and, most importantly, great kind of a managed portfolio. That remains the core of anyway what high net worth individuals do. To your point, because our pricing reduces the larger the account, so the more money you have with us, the lower the percentage you're going to pay in fees. Obviously, the unit economics at the for larger clients are actually worse than unit economics for small clients in terms of percentage. But obviously, at a client level, then becomes the absolute amount become larger.
So it still makes sense for you to focus on the mass affluent market as opposed and the high net worth individuals who want your basic proposition, as opposed to the Reserve looks to be more of an ancillary part of the portfolio. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's I mean, Reserve again is a segment. Some of the products of Reserve, so private equity, private credit, are
add-ons.
People should have 10% of your money in private markets. You should not have 90%, and so the majority of your money should be in well-diversified portfolios, and that's the core of our offering.
In a bid to improve margins, would you ever consider other types of products?
We continuously think about other products. We never do that to improve margins. Mm. So the logic is always, what is the problem we're trying to solve? Does it fit with our core values? And one of them is being cost effective. So, that kind of goes a bit against them, trying to get more margins. But anyway, and therefore, so we continuously look at that. And does it help our clients build wealth? Remember, the mission we always go back to is empowering people to build wealth in the long, build and protect wealth in the long term. So we always go back to that. Does this new potential product help with that? And are we able to do it in a way that is simple, cost-effective, intelligent?
So everything comes back to that in terms of product development. When we look at digital financial services, digital lending seems to be that lucrative part of that pie. Is that something that's a possibility in the future or not on the cards?
Look, we always look at ancillary areas, and then we drive it back to, can these help people build wealth? So if you tell me, look, would you launch a lending product? And my answer would be, look, if we think that we can launch it in a way that enable people to be more efficient and therefore build their wealth, then I would consider that. Yes. Now, is that the core of, is going to be the core of our offering? No. You know, the core of our offering works well. People like it. You know, we've been doing it for 8 years, and it's just, you know, helping people do the right thing, which is diversify, invest for the long term. And that remains the core.
Folks, I've been speaking with Michele Ferrario, co-founder and CEO of digital wealth platform Stashaway. I'm Roshan Gunnison. We'll be back in just a bit here on Open for Business. So keep it here to BFM 89.9, the business station.
Boring, fake, macho. BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to Open for Business. I'm Roshan Gunnison, and this morning I've been speaking with Michele Ferrario, co-founder and CEO of digital wealth platform Stashaway. Just before the break, Michele, we were talking about product development, and you know, digital lending is a more lucrative spot in the digital financial services space, but to you and Stashaway, it comes down to, again, how does it add value to the wealth creation side of things? It's one thing I've seen some other players do is things like portfolio line of credit, right? It's so I don't have to sell my assets and I can let that compound, but I can maybe borrow it for, you know, particular purposes. Is that something that's on the roadmap or possibilities?
It's something that I think it can be done in a way that makes sense. Mm-hmm. We haven't looked at it in detail, so I think Wellfront does it in the US.
Yeah.
And I think it's an interesting product, yes.
And in terms of finances, I know there's a limited amount that you're going to be able to say, so I'll just preempt everyone on that. As per financial reports obtained from Venture Cap Insights cited by Tech in Asia, 2022 Stashaway revenue rose by 13% to around $7 million US. Losses narrowed to around 27 million Sing dollars that year. So it's still loss-making in 2022, which we talked about a little earlier as well. Tell us a little bit about how Stashaway did in 2023 and what's going to drive growth for this company. Because again, this is a scale play.
Yeah, so I'm actually quite happy that in 2022 we posted growth, even if obviously it's not gigantic growth. But, you know, but 2022 was a horrible market. Yeah. And so the fact that we kept growing is actually great. And 2023, in the second half of the year, we grew extremely well. Mm-hmm. So it might not show in the full year numbers, but actually in the second half of the year, we grew extremely well. And between 2022 and 2023, we focus very much on continuing to grow the business while at the same time making sure we actually approach profitability. And we made gigantic steps. I cannot tell you too much because, as you know, I cannot talk about the kind of future numbers. But what I can tell you is that, you know, the 2023 numbers, and in particular the last few months numbers, actually show a very, 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 very clear path to getting profitable. As I mentioned earlier, the unit economics of the business always looked great since 2017. The focus of the last 2 years combined with scale that we have reached over time actually at this point allow us to make decisions on when we want to become profitable and, you know, deciding on how aggressive we want to be in our investments and therefore on the other side, whether we are happy to kind of be profitable immediately or just wait a little bit longer.
So AUM is a big part in what dictates, I guess, whether you reach profitability or not, aside from being capital efficient, of course, and cost efficient. You hit $1 billion US in AUM in 2021, if I'm not mistaken. 2022, probably not the best year, but still saw some growth in terms of revenue. 2023, the second half, a lot of the market got optimistic again. And again, that will drive AUMs up as well. Longer term, it's a bit up and down, right? Market goes up, market goes down. And you're confident in reaching profitability, but how confident are you in that profitability being consistent over the next, when it does come around?
Very much so. Actually, I think one of the great features of our business model is that it's incredible. Revenues are super sticky. Mm-hmm. And so as shown in 2022, you know, worst possible year from a macro perspective for a company like ours, we still grew. You know, if you look at what happened to travel companies in April 2020, they lost 95% of revenues. You know, that's kind of how macro events affect different business models. And so, no, this is actually, I would say, one of the best features of our business model is that once you are profitable, once you get to a certain size, you are at that size as a floor. Maybe your growth rate will fluctuate a little bit, but not your core kind of core P&L. I think it's extremely stable. It is one of the beauty of the business model. It takes time to build, but also, you know, once it's built, it's there.
You know, the traditional asset managers, like your Manulife's and the big players across the world, the Vanguards. But typically, when you look at Malaysia, for example, you've got unit trust consultants and financial planners and all of that who can consult the client when things are a bit rough, when things are a bit tough. That same kind of that may not have been a parallel that people thought would be applicable to digital, right? Where, oh, things get a bit tough. No one's going to talk to me to calm me down, so I'm going to take my money out. And if you look at some forums, people were upset at what happened with StashAway. But the numbers showed growth in 2022, which was a very tough year. So how important was 2022?
So it was very important. And you said something important, right? You said, you know, in the traditional industry, there is financial advisors, mm-hmm. a relationship manager, who can handhold clients in ups and downs. But in reality, one of the problems we've been always trying to solve is that those people have a little bit of a misalignment on incentive mm-hmm. versus their clients, right? They make money selling product, churning, you know, things
sales
in
fees.
And out, sales fees, et cetera. And so I mentioned our mission a couple of times. So it starts with the word empower. Empower people to build and protect wealth for the long term. So that word empower is very important because instead of handholding clients during the downs, what we try to do is actually educate clients throughout their journey with us on the importance of staying invested, continuing investing, etc. And 2022 showed that a lot of our clients listen to us. Now, not everyone. Mm. You know, there is people that have, you know, kind of stopped investing. Not a lot of withdrawal. Not a lot of people went out, but, you know, a few people kind of reduced their investments or stopped investing new money. But a lot of clients actually kept investing. And, you know, when you look it back from today, those are the best investments you made. Mm. You know, that's the beauty of investing through the ups and downs of the market, that actually when you invest through the downs, that money actually will be, you know, invested very well at attractive prices. And so, yes, for us as a company, you know, the fact that even in 2022 we managed to grow, I think is a great testament of the fact that we built something really solid, that the clients have been trust what we're doing and how we kind of try to be stewards of their capital through the ups and downs. And we're not promising that you're never going to see a day of negative returns. That would be absurd. We're promising that if you follow some of our recommendations and you take the right risk level, you will be prepared to go through the ups and downs and face it. In your 30, 35 years of investment history, you know, between age 30 and 65 when you retire, you will go through 4 or 5 bear markets and 25 corrections. You cannot escape them. You just need to be prepared for them. You shouldn't panic and just go through them. And that's what we try to help people do.
Michele, with the few minutes we have left, let's talk about the future a little bit. And a lot of this is going to be more on the other kind of investors and investments, right? So as per private market data platform Traction, StashAway has raised a total of $75 million over 7 rounds. The last recorded round that we have available, of course, is the Series D Plus round in 2022, and that was for just under $13 million. Is StashAway still in fundraising mode at this point?
So your numbers are correct, and
okay.
I can confirm that. No, so we don't need to fundraise. Mm. We have a strong balance sheet, and as I mentioned, we're actually, you know, the economics
getting
are
there.
Getting
yeah.
there. We will continue to be opportunistic in the future. You know, there is always, once you get to a stage where you're around profitability, you can decide how aggressive you want to be on your investments. And you know, we are fortunate enough that we're kind of getting to that stage. And that also goes hand in hand with, you know, how you want to manage capital. You know, do you want to raise new capital, yes or no? And we're going to be opportunistic with that. But we are in that fortunate position of kind of being at a point where we can make those decisions. We're not forced into making some of these decisions.
So capital raised, if at all, can be purpose-driven. It can be for certain targeted endeavors.
Correct.
Is inorganic growth palatable to StashAway?
For the right opportunities, yes.
You've got a cap table that has some big players, to say the least, right? So while the VCs may not have been enthused at the start, they've certainly come in over the last few years. So you've got Peak 15 Partners, formerly Sequoia Capital, India and Southeast Asia, Eight Roads Ventures, which I think is one of your longest institutional partners, I think backed by Fidelity International. And then there's SquarePeg, the largest venture cap in fund in Australia. Capital is great, and you've raised a lot of it, but a lot of times investors can bring non-monetary value to the cap table as well. Talk to us about some of that non-monetary value.
So, as you mentioned, we are backed by a few large, successful institutions. We're also backed by a few families in the beginning, and we've built a board that is quite diverse. So we have actually eight people in the board. So there is the founders, there is the family I mentioned earlier, there is the VCs you mentioned, and they also have an independent director at the board. And I think the beauty of having a diverse set of people at the board and as shareholders is that you know people will point you in different direction and show you kind of different perspectives. And sometimes, obviously, my job is to make sure that we kind of get to a common ground, which is can be fun at times. But I think there is a lot of value in that. There is a lot of value in kind of a. So I actually go to different people for different questions. The main value that the investors have been providing is just thought leadership and intellectual power. So people that we can, as a management team, we can go to brainstorm topics, to ask for suggestions, and the VCs, for instance, because they have the luxury of spending their days looking at many companies across sectors, oftentimes across geographies. They have a lot of lateral thoughts that can be useful for us while we are focused. My daily life is focused on Stash Away only, right? So I don't have that breadth of vision that I have. And so leveraging some of that perspectives is quite important. And then on the other side, as I mentioned, working with an independent director who has been in the financial services industry for all of her career, or with Francis Rosario, who's also been financial services all of his career, it actually gives a little bit of depth into some of the decisions that we make and the long-term decision that we want to make in terms of building the company, given we are a financial services institution.
Now, Michele, as we come towards the end of the conversation, no matter how long-term your investors might be, some of them are going to want a liquidity event to exit to, maybe it doesn't have to be an M&A or an IPO. It can be a private transaction as well. But generally speaking, people are going to be wondering, what does that look like in the long term for Stashaway, right? Maybe you want to stick around and run it forever. But, is there an ambition for an IPO? Is an M&A the way forward for Stashaway? What does the future look like here?
So the way I think about it is slightly different. What we want to do is we want to build an institution that can stand on its own legs and kind of survives all of us. That's the idea. Now, whether that institution is going to be owned by a set of private investors like it is today, or by public investors in the case of an IPO, or by another institution in the case of an M&A, I honestly don't know, and I'm not too concerned about. To me, the goal is making sure that this is, self-standing, long-standing institution that can walk on its own legs forever. Over time, I'm sure that if you take a long enough time horizon, let's call it, 50 years, the answer to the question that who owns this institution will change over, and maybe there will be, times where this is going to be private, times where it's going to be public, times where it's going to be owned by large institutions, et cetera. So through a longer time frame, I think the ownership might change. But the important piece for me is, as a company, as an institution, is it, have we built something that is solid enough to withstand the test of times, the ups and downs of the markets, and everything that will happen in the next decade, 2, 3, 4, 5 decades.
Michele, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Folks, I've been speaking with Michele Ferrario. He's the co-founder and CEO of digital wealth platform Stashaway. And if you missed any part of this conversation, you can catch the full conversation on the BFM app or wherever you get your podcasts. Just look for Open for Business. I'm Roshan Kanasen. You've been listening to Open for Business. Keep it here to BFM 89.9, the business station.
You've been listening to Open for Business on BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, Download the BFM app.